Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on the companies we mention. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to Monday Upbeat Markets with me, Graham Dixon.
Me, Kevin Hornsby.
And me, Charles Archer.
So, what's been happening this week? Who wants to start?
What's been happening? Well, we might be coming to the end of a couple of wars, which would be encouraging. Let's see. Arsenal lost in the Champions League final, and it's been sunny and everybody's been on the beach.
That's a pretty good summary, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I've literally just been surfing with the children most days. That's pretty much it. I mean, half term, this is the last day of half term right now, because it's non-pupil day. But yeah. I'm quite looking forward to like a day of actual work tomorrow. But
the stock market, so at least in the small caps, seems to be booming.
I in the past five, you know, this is not me tooting my own horn at all, but we've had Delta Gold up what 3,000 since the pre-IPO. We've had Kendrick up 3,500 or so. We've had Apertura, which is up, I don't know, 20x in a week or something. And it's just the start. We've got 19 different RTOs, pre-IPOs, IPOs all coming to the market, which is probably five times as what we had a year or two ago. It's just booming. It's just the sentiment for this space is just crazy. And everybody is so, so keen to just get deals done and get cracking. And on the one side, it feels a little bit frothy. But on the other side, I just think, you know, finally a bit of sentiment back in the small cap market.
That's the way. Do you think there's a thing about cannibalization of the market? So you have to sell something in order to put it into the next situations. Therefore, it's the same coming out of the same cake.
I did originally, but then I was looking at it, and it seems that the deals that are coming to the market right kind of like fall into three separate categories. And the first category is stuff that's been banging around London for the past decade, looking for a way to list, and now finally they're able to, just because the market's so febrile. And as a general rule, those are ones to just avoid, right? Because if you can't do it in a bad market, then if you can only do it in a good market, it's generally not the greatest opportunity. Then you have things where there's been private companies that have been doing really well and just didn't think that the listing environment was good enough to come to market for a long time. Now they want to come to market, and those are looking pretty strong. And then the final one, which is quite exciting, is with space, with semiconductors, with, you know, oil frontiers, so many themes are coming to the forefront that there are new companies popping up just because the actual theme didn't exist in the past, and now it does because we're in a bull market just generically. And that's where all the money's being made, is what it feels like to me.
I was speaking to someone from an investment bank, mid-sized investment bank, a couple of weeks ago, and he said, Graham, you need to get as many companies onto AIM as possible, not the full list, not Aquis, just AIM, because he said that the number of acquisitions that have been made have taken a lot of the cash, there's a lot of cash sitting in these sort of, not EIS funds, what is it, inheritance tax funds?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
They're looking for a new home. Mm. And that's, so anything that's coming onto AIM, as long as it's qualifying, and it's got some reasonable stability about it, then it should do quite well.
Away you go. Yeah, I mean, the other thing is just structural, right? Because when the big US tech stocks are at record highs, and gold's at record highs, and bonds are at record highs, people are looking for places to diversify their risk. And ironically, the riskiest part of the market is small caps, and that's where the most genuine value can be found at the moment, simply because everything else is overvalued fundamentally.
That's true.
How much longer that can continue, we don't know, but it will end at some point. You know, small cap same will suffer a little bit, but inevitably it'll be the same, in my view, as the pandemic, where it will fall initially and then spike to new highs, because where's the money going to go?
Do you remember when Trump, when he came out with the tariffs?
Yeah.
When he came out with the tariffs, there was this sort of initial fall in London, and then we spiked, sort of outlier to America. There was, do you remember, I think it was May last year.
Mm.
It was around May time.
Victory Day. Yeah. Liberation Day. Yeah, I remember, yeah.
It's almost as if we were sailing our own ship independently of America, because, you know, it's always been that case of, you know, America sneezes, we catch a cold. It was that America sneezes and we you know, we're doing all right, Jay.
Yeah, well, we're fine. I mean, if you look at the FTSE 100 returns when you include dividends, right, and compare it to the S&P 500, we're not that far behind at all. We're really not. I mean, there seems to be this kind of mad situation where, you know, you say, oh, well, the S&P 500 goes up by, what, 10% on average every year, and the FTSE only does like 4%, say. But you add in the dividends, which are around 4% as well, and the fact that it's much less volatile, then you're gravied, you know? I think the other thing is that in the UK, there seems to be, you know, there's so much negativity, and I'm probably the source of a lot of it some of the time. But actually, if you look at the artificial intelligence investment going on in this country, yes, it's behind the US and China, but if you strip out those two superpowers, we're well above anybody else. And it's because our universities are top tier and no one can compete. So, you know, there's plenty of reasons to be bullish on the UK in general. And I think all we need is just one competent politician to turn the ship around, and it will be fine.
And who will that be?
Who will that be? I'll tell you, it'll be chaos. Right? Well, I already know how this is going to go, because you have to pick up a history book, right? Okay, we're going to have probably a reform PM at some point in the next two or three years, and that'll be a disaster. Regardless of whether you think it will be popular, it will do really unwell, mostly because the market doesn't know how to price them, so the bond market won't like it. And then we might have a little bit of fun with the Greens, maybe. But ultimately, out of the chaos, every time there is chaos in the UK, someone who we don't know yet will be forged in the ashes of the disaster, and they'll fix the problems. And I think the key thing is that a lot of it is the structural advantages of London, particularly in the finance sector, but also in biotechs and artificial intelligence. Even if we have a few bad years, we'll come out on top eventually. This is how I see it. So I think that's how we're going to go.
Well, my view is that he won't get in, but the Restore guy is the guy who's talking the most sense. But anyway, that's what we might. Yeah.
I have to say.
Let's introduce our first guest. We have Michael Jones from Delta Gold, who's going to be our first guest today. So they've had news today. So I interviewed him earlier on. Let's listen to what he has to say. Good morning and welcome to Mums, Michael. How's things going down at the Delta Gold Technology world?
We're very excited about the announcement today and where we go next, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, from that announcement, we're looking at Penn State, and not just provisional patents this time, actual patents, three of them. What do they say? London buses come three at a time. So I was a bit surprised to see three, I have to say. Can you give us any more information? This is the reality. Obviously, you have to be very limited, I think, in what is said in terms of the RNSs. But can you put any color on it for people?
I'd love to just say no, Kevin, actually, to be honest, that we'd be done. I think it's the direction of trajectory is probably the thing to take away, is that, you know, the research started with some ideas that were in a published paper, actually, which attracted us to Penn State in the first place. So it was research around gold and how gold behaves in nano clusters of the atoms. So literally, a few atoms of gold actually bundled together in a very certain way. And that research has continued with our sponsorship and really opened up an entirely new way about going about quantum information using something that's solid state and is actually a physical material. So this is a very exciting area of quantum research. It's at the base fundamental level of the physics. So we're actually looking at how you might be able to encode and to transmit and change and record quantum information. So it's a very exciting new area of research into really how to make a qubit.
Okay, very good. So we really are going to the initial physics of all of this. Because I've heard some of these grants that were granted last week, and I've heard people talking about the IBM, and IBM seem to be wanting to make the shovels. So in other words, they're the ones that want to make the qubits, but yet at the same time, I don't think anybody is settled yet on this is how you make a qubit that works. What's your thoughts on that? One, obviously the US government has suddenly decided here's $2 billion. We think this is important. And secondly, you know, what about the likes of IBM and the other companies involved? And, you know, where's Delta Gold's money?
That's exactly as you said, that the way to make a qubit, just a reminder for everybody what a qubit is. So a standard computer has a zero or a one. For a qubit, it can be a zero or a one or anything in between. So think of it as a vector that in a traditional computer is either up or down. This can point anywhere around a sphere. And so that gives the capability to host a whole lot more information. And when you have two qubits together, their possibilities multiply times each other. So you can encode and deal with a lot more information at one time. That's the essence of quantum computing and information science. And so it's the ability to be able to deal with those states in a controlled way. And the challenge has been that if we have a very high fidelity qubit, in other words, one that hangs together quite well and doesn't get disturbed by outside energy, those methods don't seem to be very scalable. We can't make a lot of them. On the ones that we can make quite a few qubits, they tend to fall apart quite quickly. We're talking about in milliseconds. So from a practical point of view of running a real computer on real problems, it's been a real challenge and continues to be a real challenge. And as you said, the way to do it is at debate, definitely, because major companies like D-Wave, like Rigetti, like IBM, like Alphabet, they are using different ways to make a fundamental quantum state on different materials in different methods completely. So given that they're investing $3 to $5 billion a year each in dealing with these qubits that are not perfect, they're not scalable, and they're not stable enough, this is a very interesting space. And we have a completely different way of doing it, we believe, and thus the filed patents. And so it's all about making something that's stable and scalable, and we're doing it from the root of the physics with some of the greatest minds in the world. And I think this is a thing where Delta really stands out, is that its university partnerships are working with some of the top people in the world, and really the patent application is a demonstration of the fact that we are making real progress.
Yeah, when I read the RNS, it's obvious that your relationship with Penn State is looking healthy from the point of view that you seem to be in the process now of negotiating it from 3 years to 6 years. I presume that's no more money per annum. It's just that the length of the contract will go out. Is that correct?
We'll see how the budget develops. We've really been pretty flexible on how this goes forward here, because we're really in the stage now of developing the next pieces of IP development. And we really want that budget to be built from the ground up. So, you know, certainly the company can handle the current expenditure rate without a problem. And we'll see how that develops. But we think that, you know, the research here is showing so much promise. We've got to show a greater commitment. And the rate of that expenditure will depend on the budgets developed technically. And, you know, we're doing experiments every day. I mean, we're busy in the lab today working on things that have come out of what we've just filed patents for. So there are some very specific things that we think will need some acceleration of expenditure, but we're still developing those plans and budgets. The facilities at Penn State, I have to say, are very impressive. We visited there and looked at the laboratories and the equipment that they have around our research that we can use. I mean, it's truly, truly a world-class facility for material science. You know, they even have what they call the bunker under a part of the building that's suspended in the air so that no vibration from the building affects that particular zone, where there are tens of millions of dollars of very sensitive atomic level equipment that we visited with. It really is quite something to be working in such a world-class place.
Yeah, I don't think people have quite gathered yet how much of an advantage you're getting above other people because of the inherent stuff that's already there, you know, from these places.
Absolutely. And the same is true at University of Toronto. Don't forget, we're working at another world-class university, you know, one of the top 10 universities in the world, at University of Toronto as well. So you know, we have access to, you know, both the equipment, but also the mines. I mean, that's what really has excited me since the beginning of this project is the opportunity for collaboration between the universities. And we continue to build that conversation. I mean, we've said that our objective is to expand our network of universities, and top academics attract other top academics. And the idea of this international collaboration with the best of the best, that's something that really has resonated. I can't say too much more about that, but we're on track on our mission here to make this a global business.
Yeah, I was going to ask the question because of your comments in the RNS saying Canada, the US, and the UK. When is the triangle going to be completed?
Well, we'll see. We've set out an objective to do this in the near term. That's all I can say.
Yeah, and I mean, those three countries are going to be a pretty big powerhouse. I mean, there's no doubt there is a lot of smart people and intelligence in this area in the United Kingdom, as well as in Canada and the US. So, yeah, I think there's nothing but blue sky ahead of you in terms of the possibilities. But this really puts a line under it that these patent applications, if they come off, the first £20 million of revenue is basically straight to Delta Gold. And then you're only losing 1% thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great agreement. And, you know, the university has a true mission. They talked to me about this, of doing great things in the world. That's their mission. And so the agreement really facilitates our investment and doing something great. You mentioned the UK. It's interesting. I visited with the director of the National Quantum Center in the UK. And I was at an event a few days ago that spoke about the commitment of the British government. And I think, you know, in the background, there's a lot of people complaining about the British government at the moment. But in the background, whether Conservative or Labour government in the UK, they have invested heavily in quantum and steadily done it, actually. And so, you know, the National Quantum Centre is a £1 billion facility. You have places like Oxford and Cambridge that are absolutely also centers of excellence of academic research supported very heavily by the government. So I think it's important to note that the UK is a real powerhouse in quantum, and that's been supported by multiple governments here in this country. In terms of collaboration, I think Canada, the UK, and the US is the right focus. And I think globally and strategically, increasingly, it's becoming recognized that this is a bit of a race. And that he who controls quantum will really have an enormous strategic advantage. So I think making this collaboration real, as you said, there's $20 billion just recently announced for quantum in the US. The UK government has been very steady about it. Canada announced a $250 million quantum center as well. So governments in this part of the world and within the Five Eyes are really starting to recognize this is a race we have to win.
Very good. So we're 6 months into this journey, if you like, or just over 6 months. Well, really 6 months, obviously from the pre-initial public offering, maybe a year into this whole situation.
Right.
You're well ahead of where I expected you to be. And I'm not talking about share price here now. I'm talking about actual what's been achieved. What can we expect in the next 6 months? Are we going to accelerate even faster, do you think, based on what you've experienced?
That's what we want to do. I mean, I recognize it hasn't been very long. I wanted to go more quickly, given the technical level that we started from. But the teams have done an amazing job, and we've developed really the way that we planned, just slightly faster, I think. It's really about you know, maximizing our momentum now, that now we have recognition that this is serious work, that it's resulting in valuable IP that we're filing, and that now we need to increase our portfolio. We need to have a broader reach. You know, adding the UK is a key objective we've talked about, and also bringing these minds together. One of the things I'm very excited about it is a planned event we have to bring the principal investigators and their postdoctoral fellows to one room with an enormous whiteboard and see what happens. And I confess I probably won't understand 90% of what they say in quantum physics world. But you know, that technical collaboration, I think, is going to be enormously powerful. And you know, we can be as company owners, we can be very proud of the teams that we have on working on this. And we were joking with somebody we're hoping to bring onto the team here just recently. And I said to them, you know, it feels like if one of the big companies wants to come and kind of have a go at us, come and have a go at our physicists. Let's see how you make out. And he just kind of giggled. He's like, yeah, that's correct. You know, if you're a big company and you want to criticize our science, be my guest. Let's see how that goes for you. So,
yeah.
You know, we can definitely defend what we've put together on a technical and academic basis. We're 100% sure of that. And that gives us enormous confidence as a company.
But more likely with the literally, as you've discussed, billions of dollars that are pouring into this particular area. And obviously the US government has turned around and said, here's $2 billion, which actually in the grand scheme of things is not actually that much money in terms of how much is going into these areas. Is, you know, these people are going to have big checkbooks and they're going to want a part of what you've got, either a part or all of it. And I can see that. And in the not too distant future, you're going to have institutions or institutional investors thinking, no, we need a part of this, because if you guys come up with the right patents, what's going to happen?
Well, I mean, I've lived hostile takeover bids before. I've lived mergers and amalgamations many times. I've lived partnerships many times. So, you know, we're very au fait about how to go for best value. And the key thing is to drive your business forward, not get too fussed about which path you're going to take to maximize value, be opportunistic, but have your defenses ready, both in terms of the best legal teams in the world. That's why we're working with Hayes Boone. I mean, they do the patents for NVIDIA. They've filed 19,000 patents out of their office. They definitely know what they're doing. It's the A-plus team. And, you know, in terms of investment banking, this is something we intend to grow, particularly in the U.S. We're getting to a stage where we need to start thinking about our overall corporate structure and how we look after best value. So, you know, engaging with some of the much larger investment banks in the world will be something we'll be looking at in the not too distant future. We think we have something that we really need to defend for best value here.
And just like you took Guardian Metal Resources onto the New York Stock Exchange as an ADR, can I see the same picture by the end of the year for Delta Gold, that you're going to do exactly the same thing? It seems rather stupid's the wrong word, but rather crazy not to have a quantum business that is listed either NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah, typically tech stocks list on NASDAQ rather than the New York Stock Exchange. I actually really have an affinity for the New York Stock Exchange. And when I was there with Oliver Friesen for the listing of Guardian, and I worked on some of the background documents and relationships there as a strategic advisor. And I was very proud to be there for the bell ringing of Guardian. And it was actually my third one. It's the third time I've rang the bell of the New York Stock Exchange. So it's definitely a space we know, and we trade OTC already in the U.S. I think that's a market we can actually develop in the near term with some media and some investor relations. I mean, to be honest with you, we haven't done a lot of investor relations at all. I mean, we've been so busy with the technical side of the business and building the bricks on the wall that we haven't done a lot of investor relations. But definitely the U.S. market is a place where this company should really resonate. And of course, it has the local branding of being a partner with Penn State as well.
Yeah, I think my view is you've got to get the triangle sorted out first, and then you'll be you'll be ready to rock and roll. But that's for another day, maybe.
Well, we got a lot ahead of us, that's for sure.
Indeed. Anyway, been great to speak to you, Michael. We haven't been very complicated about quantum, which is probably a good thing, and good luck, and I hope to speak to you soon.
Well, stay in touch. Thanks very much, Kevin.
Hello, and welcome to Monday Upbeat Markets. And we have right with us now Dr. Marco Scherblum, the CEO of Finno. Welcome to Monday Upbeat Markets.
Hi, Graham. Well pronounced.
Thank you very much. I've rehearsed all this weekend. Marco, can you tell us about your background, particularly the bit about the athletic side and how this led to the creation of Finu?
Yeah, I'm with pleasure, of course, and thanks. Happy to be here. So I have a lengthy athletics background, but where I had most of my success was in American football. So this was mid-90s. I'm a European champion. I was the best player in Europe by the Federation in 1995. And so I played with the Finnish national team at the time. But before that, I played ice hockey, and then I was a track and field, so a sprinter. That's how I ended up in American football. And yeah, we talked a little bit about that. I personally have a soft spot on all former elite athletes in any sport, simply because I think it's hard to get to top level. And that carries well in the business world, because you get knocked down and you have to sort of get up and try again and find your way. The persistence is the key word. I think it was Will Carling who was, you may remember, he was actually lecturing about this link between business and rugby a long time ago. And I thought that really resonated with me. So part of that was the reason that I ended up in Cambridge, because they were building a football program at the time. And I've been in sort of on this journey ever since. So came to the UK mid-90s, and then from there went to Bath. Ended up more recently doing my PhD in AI and overdrafts from France. But to your earlier part of your question, how did we end up with Finu? Well, I had a business before Finu, very similar to it, which was overdraft style lender in the UK. This was during the sort of a OFT era, where the high cost short term credit market was less regulated. And we had more than 5 million customers overdraft style. And the FCA sort of changed the legislation following more or less what our business model was all about, very fair and capping the interest and so on. And after I sold that business, I then said, well, lessons learned. One of the key points or problems we had at the time was funding, regular funding. So deposits would obviously solve that problem. And I thought, let's go on this banking route. That was 2017.
Okay, very good. So, okay, and I see Finu are concentrating on the UK, which kind of makes sense given you're listed here. But you know, the current accounts, there's lots of current accounts that don't have an overdraft facility. So what would you say is the total addressable market for Finu just in the UK alone?
If you look at the pure numbers in terms of customers, it's about 30 million people. And it sounds big, and it is big, but that's based on the FCA data. So there was a major reform in the market in around 2019 and 2020. Prior to that reform, prior to when it was introduced, we had about 30 million people using some form of overdraft at least once per year. And then when the reform was introduced, we had overnight 16.5 million people who lost access because certain product was removed from the market. And then more recently, there's been another 6 or 7 million people who've lost access because banks are looking at this from a risk-weighted assets perspective and the capital they need to tie. So they're offering this product to higher end of the market who don't necessarily need it. So again, data from, I love data, by the way, sorry if I bore you to death with that, but we bought some data from the credit reference agencies, and in the last 12 months, only 10% of newly opened bank accounts get access to an overdraft. And this is where we come in. So it used to be about 60% of people who used it, and our overdraft or the underwriting methodology allows banks to underwrite closer to about 60%. So it's kind of like reopening that market, if you like. So it's a massive, it's a huge mass market, Graham. But let me correct you on one thing. Our banking initiative was a UK-based, but we've always said this is not about a UK-specific problem. It's a global problem. Where we have a massive opportunity is across Europe, just and in America as well. So the white labeling technology, which were, you know, about to launch, put it this way, with Conestor Bank, has an incredible potential across Europe alone. You have 5,000 banks. And the question is, it's a little bit like, I know you and Kevin, you've looked into mining previously as an example. So it's kind of like you could think of these banks as mines. How likely it is that you'll find another mine and another mine and another mine that will suddenly produce you something. And so this Conestor Bank in the UK is kind of like a pilot to us at the moment. Of course, we did have our own banking license, but we had to surrender the license back.
Yeah. And I see that you had a few delays with Conestor Bank in terms of the launch. Are you on track to get it launched this quarter? Do you think it might slip into Q3?
Yeah, do you know what? I can't answer that as of today. We will make certain announcements in relation to that. But the way I look at it is, statistically, these types of arrangements where you're bringing a full core banking system, these tend to be more than 20 years. So yes. Even Starling Bank have put out a certain press releases that they've signed, I think, 4 deals, and they're saying it's minimum 10 years. I've operated in this space within Central European market, DAX 30 companies especially, and these were implemented nearly 30 years ago, and they're still running on them.
It's worth getting it all, you know, properly done, and then once you've done it, you're
precisely. So you can basically cook it up at the start, and then, but if you don't cook it up, you're looking at a multi-year arrangement, because these are material outsourcing arrangements. They are very tricky to change. That's why a lot of legacy banks, as an example, they struggle a little bit with some of the newer kids on the block, the Revoluts of this world, because they're built on a completely different, you know, tech stack.
Yes, yeah. I mean, we're talking about Revoluts and the other sort of challenger banks. I mean, given that they're so innovative, is that a concern that they just innovate something that just usurps what you're doing, or is that not a concern?
If you really drill into, which is obviously what we do, and I'm sure you do as well, our favorite is actually Nubank. And that's a kind of like that's what we want. We want to develop or create rather a kind of like a new European version of Nubank, which is credit first approach. Revolut, by way of example, has attracted lots of customers, but it's not a credit first product. It's like a free FX, and they've done really well. If you then compare Starling, Monzo, N26, whole host of others, you'll kind of see that what's their flagship product has been. So the key is to get to large volumes. And in our case, because it is a credit-first approach, so obviously we need a banking license to do our own lending. But because the market is so wide and huge, if I put UK and Europe together, best estimate is it's about 150 million people would want this product every month. And now we wouldn't be able to raise enough probably regulatory capital and even want to raise that kind of money to serve everybody, because overdraft risk-weighted assets tend to be high. So it's 75 to 100% depending on the country, but they tend to be the general rules. That means you have to reserve capital on the side, but obviously these are most profitable products under the normal retail banking. And so to answer your question about wouldn't it be easy for them just to do something like that? No, it's not that simple, because the key to this particular product that we have, it's an unbundled. And Revolut, as an example, is going the other direction, which is bundling everything. So it's becoming a super app. What we want to do is we want to take apart the most profitable parts and just leave all the costs to everybody else. So you've got certain credit products that are always profitable. So what we're saying is cards, they tend to be loss-making, as an example, until you get to large volumes. So we're saying, we'll leave the card to HSBC and Barclays because they cost money. And running the current account, this doesn't really, it's not really profitable. And according to FCA, as an example, overdraft on a standalone basis, generates on average in the UK 56% return on equity. So what we're saying is we'll take that, leave you to deal with the cost. So that's just, so it's a completely different approach. Now, it is a flagship product. It's not to say that we couldn't add other products, even mortgage. We could unbundle mortgage as well. We know that we can do that. But it's first, we're kind of like fairly early in this cycle, although it's been a long journey. But that's kind of like what the direction of travel is.
Okay. And, just looking at your, like the time period where when you have your initial sort of contract with a suitable bank and you want to put your plug-in overdraft facility in it, how long does it take for the initial contract with the client to them deploying the facility with their own customers? What sort of time period are we talking about?
This is a brilliant question, by the way. So I have a couple of tangible comparatives here. So first of all, when we did this to ourselves from scratch, it was a 9-month journey when we were in control of everything from zero to launch readiness, including customer support, 9 months. That includes full core banking system. The first customer, Conister, it's a complicated one. It's not the same because you're dealing with kind of like a tri-party arrangement. You've got different third parties. We're learning, they're learning. Two different cultures. Everybody wants to make sure that it's correct. You've got the regulators also, not the UK, but the Isle of Man, who are the lead regulators. So it's not necessarily a brilliant example. It has taken us longer than 9 months already.
Do you think 9 months is probably what it will typically be once?
I'd say no. So what we've done already in parallel, we have a European version now. I have the app already in my phone, and we're starting to engage with some European banks. Depending on the sort of agility of that particular counterparty, if it was a huge multinational, it would just take 6 months just to get the contract across the line because they are slow. But if it was more agile from contract signing to launch, we have a pre-configured environment that could be launched in 2 months, 3 months.
Okay. All right.
Technically, it's ready to launch within a week, but they would always want to do some testing on their own and change a logo, color, or whatever. These are the things. But technically speaking, it's not difficult to launch it in Europe, as an example. UK, of course, we're now doing this initially with Conister on an exclusive basis. So we wouldn't be looking at another bank in the UK.
Okay, good. All right, let's just switch over now to your FX business in Poland. Can you tell us about this and also tell us about the legal case you have and what, you know, how you're getting on with this non-compete situation?
Yeah, so first of all, the FX business itself is doing very simple, very plain vanilla FX product. So it works an exemption. In other words, it's helping the importers and exporters to hedge their forward contracts. So that's the only thing it does. So it has to deal with imports. So there must be physical goods. Like it could be a strawberry farmer selling goods to Germany. So 80% of that business is between EU countries. So PLN and euro currency pair. And these are sort of mid-sized companies, 20, 25 million type of turnovers, profitable, but then the banks are, they're kind of falling in between where they're not big enough for banks to provide them a great service, but they are big enough then still wanting to hedge their position. So it's a forward contracts. That's what that business is. It's the only thing that it's doing. And it's signing good new customers. We've done a big turnaround in that business. As you rightly pointed out, you asked about the litigation or the pre-trial, whatever the word you used. I can't comment on that, as you can imagine. But what we have done and said publicly so far is that we're at the pre-trial stages, and we'll see if and when we want to make certain announcements accordingly. There's a whole host of lawyers and legal advice that I need to, of course, share before I say anything further on that.
Mark, go on. No, Mark, I was just going to say, I mean, the, It seemed quite left field when you made the acquisition. I did wonder, you know, is there any sort of crossover between the FX business and the plug-in overdraft, or are they just totally independent?
Yeah, so there's a massive, massive link between the two. So I believe in our bigger plan, which is so we've always said we want to have also a European owned banking operation, that is. And so Poland is a brilliant market. It's growing a lot. And what we're looking at here is expanding the plug-in overdraft into the SME space. And so let's just say we have 500 active customers in Poland. And if we find ourselves in a position where we end up having a banking license, say, in Europe, it would be logical for us to obviously offer those additional services to our existing FX customers. And we have identified already early that a number of these customers, they have needs for factoring, as an example, short-term financing, a little bit like overdraft style, but they would be happy to even sell their invoices because they get ridiculously bad payment terms. So if you're a strawberry farmer and you sell £1 million worth of strawberries to, I don't know, Metro in Germany, you're lucky if you get paid 90 days DDP, which is delivered duty paid. And you have because you have to pay people at the field when they pick it, when they pick the strawberries. This is very typical in the import-export business. So the late payments is a massive problem. And then Polish banks are offering some such services, but they are quite steep, if you ask me, 20%+ annual. And we're saying, well, why not give them fair deal? You know, 1 month, 2 month, 3 month cash flows, buffers, overdraft style. And so that's where the link is. Mm. We're far from it today, of course, because we don't have a European bank. We don't have the funding for it. But of course, that's the ambition. That's the longer term ambition.
Well, I can see you achieving that with your sort of background and your athletic background. You can take the ups and downs, and your determination's very obvious. Now I see that you've got over £5 million of cash at the end of December, and your burn rate is less than £200,000 per month. So is that burn rate still the case? And aren't you due to come out with your results for last year?
I think we came out with that already earlier. You're absolutely right. It was just shy of 5 million cash, and the burn rate monthly was around 220, I think, 200, something like that. So yeah. That divided, obviously, with, 5 million divided by, say, 220, I think it's around 21 or 22 months.
Yeah.
So that's a good, healthy position overall. Had there been major changes, we would have, of course, announced that, this is why it's gone up or down dramatically, and we haven't done that. So, obviously you could then come to conclusion that it's a stable situation that we're in, of course. And that doesn't take into account, that's the existing cash, as an example. It doesn't take into account any of the incoming plans that we've got, be it the white label or any other thing that we might be working on.
Okay. I mean, I remember, when it was immediate, then it became immediate acquisitions. You did the RTO at 20p a share. You flirted a couple of times. When was the RTO? Was it about 4 years ago or something, wasn't it?
Four or five years? You're right. Yeah, it was 2022, summer. Yeah, that's when we got the bank license.
So you kind of got a couple of times over 20p, and then you had this horrendous fall. I mean, don't get me wrong, everyone had a horrendous fall by and large. So.
Oh, but ours was even worse. I agree.
But it was horrible, down to half a penny, and it stood there for quite a long time. Now you're resting at 7.5p. When I saw your statement on the 8th of September last year, and I want to congratulate you for actually sticking your neck on the block, so to speak, because you don't often see this from a CEO that actually states their sort of share price objective, which is basically what we're here about, right? It's fine and good talking about, plans and, profits and blah, blah, blah. But as far as a shareholder is concerned, he wants to buy here and sell here. And you've said that your share price objective is 110p and a market cap of £440 million over a 36-month period. So congratulations on saying that. So in your opinion, what do you need to achieve over the next, well, you've got about another 2.25 years. So what do you need to achieve in order to reach this goal?
Don't answer that, Marco. You're not allowed to answer that. No,
I am allowed to. It is in the public domain. And so I'm allowed to answer that. I'm going to answer that. But before I do that, so to keep the attention on, I'm going to bring you back to that point that you mentioned, Graham, which was January 2024. So I re-inherited, if you like, the company back as a CEO at that point.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Sorry, the share price was half a penny, whatever it was, January 2024. And we had probably 200,000-300,000 cash left. We had just laid off everybody. It was me and two board members. It was a dire, awful situation. It was one of those where the board was asking, should we call in the liquidators? I said, no, this is what we're going to do. And then I presented the strategy. Obviously, it took a while. But fast forwarding, say, 2 years forward, end of 2025, We have a revenue generating business. We've got 30 staff or so, 5 million cash at bank. We managed to get from half a penny to, you know, like you said, to even to 20 at one point, but now it's like a 7 or 8. We've got obviously a white label deal about to be launched. So this has happened in a period of 2 years now. It is, and of course, the share price went from half a penny to, I think it raised 1,500% or something in 2025. So whilst it is a journey, and that is a baseline. Now, one of the other points to remember here that I put, the last time I had a chance to put money into the company, I put it in at 20p a share.
Yes.
And I put £1 million myself at 20p a share. So therefore, being at these levels, or at, say, 10p levels, I'm still down. I'm not happy, camper. And this price, coming back to your answer, so this price target of 110 is a real target. I have put my skin in the game. I'm saying, you know, I've agreed with the board and the remuneration committee that this is a target where you will award me. I'm going to achieve that. But give me 3 years to execute. This is what we're going to do. Now, I'm not going to be able to answer every step how we're going to do that, Krim. But linearly speaking, it would mean that if you break down the 3 year kind of cycle, linearly speaking, it would mean that every year the share price increases by about 33 pence from 10p baseline. And of course, you don't achieve that without some milestones. Either there's a big event. Typically, there would need to be a big event, and then things will then fall in place. Now, one of these types of big events in our case could be, which we've set out in our admission document, is our banking plan. In other words, if somebody comes to me and gives me a check for, say, 35 million, I will have a banking license either in the UK or in Europe, and then we'll start executing things. And we can guarantee that, obviously. So as you can imagine, that banking plan will put us in a different place. We're a fintech selling our white label. We have an FX, and now we bring in a banking license. And now we're back on this path of, okay, can we compare this to Monzo's and others? Are they actually signing more customers in terms of retail customers? And this is where Conister plays a very important role in many ways, because it is a pilot. And it's a little bit like some of your, I listened to some of your earlier, or Kevin was talking about the mining companies as an example. So it's kind of like, you know, you drill a hole, that's where you know how much copper or gold you're going to get actually out of it. This is a similar situation we have with our first white label customer. Because when the performance data comes out, I know how it works already, but that's not good enough. We're going to obviously publish, and same with Manx, they're going to publish some of this performance data. And when people realize how good that performance data is, this is a golden find, basically. And now the question is, are you able to drill more holes because you've got 5 million, sorry, not 5 million, but 5,000 banks across Europe?
Yes. Who needs this? It's almost sort of a big advert.
Exactly that. It's a pilot. It's a complete pilot. And yeah. But it's a massive, because as I said, I've already done this business before, not under the banking perimeter. And I know the model. I built the model. And so I know it, but others don't. And so I'm kind of saying, let me prove you wrong, or let me show what the performance data looks like. but it needs to be factual based. It's not good enough for me to say, well, I know it works.
So Marco, I have a question for you more about the intricacies of the finance. So let's assume it goes into X number of bank accounts. How much money do you tend to make? And there's two examples, obviously. You're white labeling this for somebody.
Yep.
So how do you get paid? Do you get paid a percentage of the interest that they have to pay, or do you get paid for each client that actually takes it up and then a percentage of the interest? And how will that differ that if you have your own license and you do this yourself?
Very good question. So you have kind of like two questions there. So let me start with the white label. So the white labels at this stage, because there is only one, it's kind of like we tailor the pricing per each customer or each bank that we're in talks with. The first one is based on fees plus profit share. So whatever they make, we'll make a cut basically of that, which then brings us back to your first question about how would we make money and how much money we would make. Now, the modeling varies from country to country a little bit. And if you compare, say, digital banks, how much they generate usually income per customer, revenue per customer per year, they, you know, some of them are sort of above £250 per year. Revolut is low, like 40, 50, something like that, if I'm not mistaken. Ours would be somewhere in between the two. It depends on the usage and the customers you apply. So it's not, I'd probably say round numbers, it's probably £100 to £150 a customer per year, roughly. That's the income revenue you generate from one individual, because they use the product regularly, but not too much. And the fees for these types of product are, they look high, but so if you, by way of example, let's just say that you end on a little bit of higher end, so you, so lower end in terms of the risk, higher end on the risk, but lower end on the charges. So let's just say that you charged 30 pence per day for £100 borrowed. Now for the customer, 30 pence, yes, it sounds high, but if you use it for 10 days, you pay £3. And it's possible that within that 10-day period, they would miss, as an example, a electricity bill or council tax bill. That costs them £12 to miss that payment. Now, so this is the choice we're bringing to the market. Would you rather pay £12 fee to your electricity provider or your council tax? Or would you rather pay £3 to us and not incur that fee? So you save £9 by having this facility in situ. And this is not a small feat. There are nearly 20 million people who miss these payments every year in the UK alone. And they miss more than one payment. So this is one use case of many. And it's a huge volume market overall, which is why we have this robot. So there's no human touch. It's everything is done by AI and robots. No people involved.
Okay, so how confident are you, obviously, with the £110 share price target? You're obviously fairly confident. But how confident are you that this can go into Europe and I suppose the real market would be into America and actually just adjust itself to have, I mean, maybe not even just America. You've got Central America, you've got South America. The blue sky of this is huge. So there's two questions. How confident are you can do that? And secondly, how confident are you that somebody can't just come along and replicate what you've done?
So me personally, I'm very confident. I have a skin in the game. I put in a lot of money into this company. I'm the founder, I'm the CEO, so I'm driving it, obviously. Me personally, when I invest into companies, I like that kind of combination where it's not a dictatorship, but I have a lot of skin in the game. So somebody who believes in it, I've lived through this cycle before over a 9-year period with my previous firm. So I am incredibly confident, but the markets need to see some action and traction. So we therefore now need to execute when it comes to European in particular. That's why I've also, of course, agreed with all of these somewhat aggressive sounding bonus targets for myself. I said, I will achieve that. And I've achieved it previously. So the way I look at it is, have I achieved things in the past, whether it's my sporting background or whether it's in my professional career? Systematically, yes. There is no complete fall down anyway. It's like a pattern that goes up, up, up. And therefore, of course, I'm incredibly bullish on my own ability to deliver. It's then we will see this in 3 years' time and we can have this other discussion. We can book it already and say, okay, let's have this discussion. This is what you said at the time. What do you think of now? I think I will be the last one who will be laughing. So let's see. But
you've gone through a lot of pain, so you deserve
it. Yeah, of course. And I haven't given up in this difficult time. So, but of course, this is not an investment advice. People need to make up their own minds. They need to do their own research. I'm not giving any suggestions that you should invest or anything like that. I'm just saying who I am or what I believe in, and I'm entitled to say that. To your other points, Kevin, US is the holy grail of this market. It is ridiculously big. There are a couple of players like Dave who is doing quite well, and they are like the poor cousin of what we do. They are not a bank. They are not an overdraft. They are some sort of a overdraft protection product, and they are still listed in the NYSE, what, 2 to 3 billion. Dollar market cap, and they are growing. And in the US, they are kind of lagging in terms of the overdraft reforms. They are still charging, banks are still charging $35 per use when you go overdrawn. So there's a massive market in there. We just need to land basically a bank there to get this going. And then finally, your question about the competition, Kevin. We welcome competition. This is what we're doing in terms of unbundling is a little bit difficult to get your head around because it's a kind of like creating a new market. And so, you know, the market is so big that we don't need to own the market ourselves. Others will say, well, we also want to do that, which will then give us more speed as a unit. You could think of buy now, pay later as an example, a similar thing that, you know, when it first started to happen, it was pretty much Klarna. And now there's, I don't know, hundreds of them.
This is what I'm asking your question, Kevin. You're on death row, Dr. Marco Sherblom. Keir Starmer thinks you've made too much money on your stocks. And he's told you you've got to be executed. So what will your final meal be?
Oh, my God. What a question. Probably, I like cheese, so probably Chateaubriand. So it's a mix of things, and then and I would probably like Béarnaise sauce on the side, which is brilliant also for pizza.
What sauce?
Béarnaise sauce, which is brilliant also for replacement.
You have that with asparagus, don't you? Typically,
you can have it with beef normally, but asparagus. So what would be yours?
Okay, so the other question we normally ask you, Marco, is what is the best advice you've ever got as in received, and what is the best advice you've ever given?
Best is make sure that your wife is happy at all times. Because
have you actually achieved that? Because I'm not sure that's possible at all times.
At times, and it's a good target. Because it makes your life much easier. So listen to your spouse, wife, girlfriend, and it does make your life. Our men lives tend to be much better when we've got strong women around us. It's tough at times to understand how a woman brain works, but in reality, that's what actually makes us tick much better. That would be the best advice I would give to anybody. Kevin, did you say what was the worst advice?
The best advice you've ever received of that.
So the best advice is relating to that. So that is the best advice I've been given. Make sure that your better half is well served and happy, because happy wife, happy life.
Yeah. I think indeed. What he meant to ask was, what's the best piece of advice you've given others?
Oh, but, well, I think this would be a dull if I said that would be, I would just put that forward. I'd probably say it's the persistence that I mentioned. Yeah. Don't give up. It's easy when I've been, you know, spending a lot of time with professional athletes, Olympic champions and coaches and people like that. It's easy to have those discussions. They share that view, which is, to anybody who's ever in doubt, just be persistent, continue. Don't give up very easily, because ultimately it will be worth it. There are obviously times where it's better to say, this is enough, but you can still have a wider ambitions, and as long as you carry on that, you know, it will result in success.
Okay. And Marco, what's the best way of people tuning into your views and getting in touch with you? What's the best way of doing it?
Me personally, it would be LinkedIn. I don't really use any other social media than LinkedIn. But as you know, as we're public, I'm obviously quite conservative what I say. So, you can try to read between the lines sometimes, a little bit, get into my brain in terms of my thinking or how strong I am on things. That will be probably on a personal front. And of course, the company, RNSs, whether it's on our website or in the London Stock Exchange. So that's okay. another, if you're more analytical in mind and you do research and don't care about social media or personality as such.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, Dr. Marco Sherblum, thank you so much for being on Monday Upbeat Markets. Look forward to watching Finu thrive.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Anything of notes that's catching your eye at the moment, Charles or Kevin? Any stocks?
Well, however you pronounce it, Apatura Energy seems to have had quite an open, let's say. From 90p on Friday to, I think there was buys at 190. I think it might have settled down a bit as we record this. Mm. But not a lot of stock about in this one, Charles. And already 20 million market cap. Do you think it's crazily priced? Or based on what's going on, is this just the beginning of something that could be worth a lot of money?
Two things to consider. The first is that, at the moment, it is quite frothy, right? As in, it has gone up massively very, very quickly, and I may have had a small part to play in that. The second thing is, we are still just at the very start of the story. So I think there's hugely more gains to come. Having said that, I would say it just has to have been the case this year, as in the first 5 months of it, that I've made all of my money from stocks going on parabolic runs, rather than my usual thing where you know, I've got lots of companies going up sort of slowly, relaxingly. It seems to be a lot of my portfolio is basically flat, but a few winners.
Yeah, it's what happens when everything. You get to know me a bit better, Charles. This is what happens, man. we take more risk.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think the other thing is, you know, even five years ago, if something was doing really well, I'd sell it to make profit. Whereas now I've got a bit of cash in the bank, you can just let those winners run and run and run. And I think that, you know, for Apatura, for Kendrick, for Delta, there's a couple more coming to market as well that I'm really, really excited about. We're going to see some more parabolic runs. I will say, though, you know, to people listening, if you're a sophisticated investor, you know what you're doing. If you're a retail investor, there is no shame in taking some profit on the way up. At all. In fact, you know, and there's no problem, you know, or at least I don't have any problem use risk management tools like stop losses. But I think, you know, this market, this froth is just about going, and we've got the SpaceX IPO coming up as well, and the Anthropic IPO, and the OpenAI IPO. And while ultimately I think those are going to be not great for the US market, there's going to be so much cash running around this market. And it's all looking for a home, and we're providing one. So we shall see.
But the funny thing is that some of them, we in our mindset over the last 3 or 4 years are now thinking of frothing. Okay, from a US perspective, they haven't even put the coffee in yet. Okay, never mind frothing. Okay, from a resource basis, a lot of these stocks are so undervalued, it is beyond belief. You know, we had this discussion on the roast, and I gave 3 that I thought were going to be 10 baggers, and I've got another 10 that could be 10 baggers in my view. And they're on the fundamentals, not just on froth. So I think we're approaching a period of time that we've been waiting a long time for, but in the next, you know, year, 2 years, 3 years, we're going on a resource based bull run for sure. And, you know, I think these valuations are going to be laughed at in the future.
I mean, we've been through a bit. I mean, I've been doing this since 1999, which is the on boom. But that bear market we had, which I think from memory was September 2021 was the peak of AIM at that time. And it's been the worst bear market I have ever come across. And I was speaking to people much older than me, and they've said it's the worst bear market they've ever seen in their career.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've seen that. And I think ever since the Bitcoin treasury plays made their sort of entree into the UK scene, that for me was like that was the bottom of the bear market, I think. Mm-hmm.
Potentially it's the first time that US capital entered the UK market en masse. You've noticed, you know, since then, companies sporting an OTC listing, right? And nothing happens on the OTC, and then one day the volume just picks up and it just runs with it. And I often think a lot of these, and how many companies do we know, you know, whether this is known publicly or not, so many are looking to do OTC listings, NYSE listings, NASDAQ listings in the future, looking to seek out that American capital base. Kevin just said, you know, like how undervalued UK stocks are in general.
Mm.
And the really funny thing is when you get to the US listing, everything, you know, I spent a lot of the past year in New York. It's really hard for UK investors to understand just how much money is floating around the US and just how, you know, fearless it is. You know, they'll put money into anything. They don't worry if it goes up or down. They're looking for growth. You know, whereas the UK market is so much more scared because it's been scarred by the bear market. But the valuations, I mean, I own material percentages in the stocks that, you know, were market caps that were sort of £1-2 million a couple of years ago that rocketed up. Mm. And they're just going to keep going because fundamentally they're undervalued. So we shall see, but I'm feeling very bullish on the UK in general, but I also think proper risk management at the same time is important. So
you did right, Charles. And risk management is important. Brackets. I'm not going to follow these rules. I'm going to
learn. No, not at all. I have no interest.
I have to say, if you have a stock that has gone up 4,000%, and suddenly it's 40% or 50% of your overall portfolio. I'm sorry, guys, but you've got to sell some of that, okay?
Yeah.
And you've got to pick the other ones that you think, okay, there's got the next chance to do the next thing. Now, if you don't do that, I don't want to sort of let you cry on my shoulder if things go wrong. Now, if things don't go wrong, then maybe it goes to the moon and you retire and all the rest of it, but...
No,
you know, if we're going to look at how things should work, you should be slicing all the way up, especially if you had that type of a winner.
It happened to me. I had a stock. It went up. It was 300 times. Now, I took my money out.
Did you say 300 times?
300 times. 300 times. It went out 300 times. I took my initial capital out, but it was still, even after I took my initial capital out, it was still 75% of my portfolio. And I just got greedy. I don't want to broadcast the figure, but it was a humongous sum of money that I left on the table because I thought I could make it worth an even bigger. And then it all went Pete Tong. So,
but the thing is, the mentality behind it, I want to try and change people's mentality, okay? Think about decreasing percentage returns that you're getting, not the amount of money that's actually involved. So let's say it's £100,000, okay? If it doubles, then you have basically got £200,000. But I'm saying to you, if you got another stock that if you reduce that by £50,000 and you put it into another stock that did 300%, then you'd be in a situation when this one's already done 1,000%, then you would be better off because your money will be worth more. So this is the mentality I'm trying to get into is you are as the stock goes up and up and up and up and up, you do go into the situation where you have decreasing percentage returns. Now, the actual physical number is growing fast. But if you then take some of that money and put it into other things that you think are going to do well, then this, to me, is the sensible move. You are diversifying, but into stuff that you believe is going to do well. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult. I'm not suggesting for 1 second it's easy because we all like, you know, come on, it can go another 50%, it can go another 30%. My 300,000 could be worth a million, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But more often than not, those things don't happen. We have seen it happening in the last while. And I also do believe it's probably going to continue to happen in quite a few stocks. But should we diversify? All I'd say to you is please do. Please do.
I would add to that, the other thing is in small caps, and particularly when things are going extraordinarily well, everyone's very bullish, everyone's very happy. But almost everyone, you'll find out, right, after the stock has you know, come out of the limelight or dropped a little bit, that the people who were saying they were the most bullish people in the entire world were managing their risk, were taking some off the top on the way up, were enjoying a little bit of profit. Now, sure, they might still make, you know, have seen a huge paper gain and then lost some of those paper gains, but almost everybody is managing their portfolio for themselves because it's not a team game. So, you know, having said that, I'm currently doing the opposite of what Kevin's saying, and I'm just running the winners all the way to the moon. But if they don't work out, you know, and then I'll still have money, and the mortgage will still basically not exist anymore, and my children will still be happy, and I can still afford to go on holidays. Now, I would suggest, and I know because I'm only 35, there's a lot of younger investors who are just starting out listening to me, and I know some of them because I get the emails have made life changing amounts of money from me, you know, and I don't give advice because I'm not qualified to do so. But what I would say to those people listening is that if you started out with like a £5,000 position at the age of 19 and you're in your second year of university and you're sitting on £100,000 because you ran one stock tip up, that is a life changing sum of money for you. Do not risk that capital. That is a big house deposit or flat deposit in London and a huge head start in life. You got lucky.
Take the 100 and stick it on something else. No, I'm only joking.
Yeah, roulette.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Well. No, my advice there would be take £20,000, put it in a bank account, take £80,000 and choose 8 more opportunities. Go for it.
Okay, chat, should we call it a wrap?
Indeed.
Yeah. Indeed.
All right. Well, look, thank you so much for tuning in to Monday Upbeat Markets. Look forward to seeing how these wonderful stocks that we talked about go. And if you like what we talk about, please like and subscribe. And remember, mum's the word.
This podcast was brought to you by Monday Upbeat Markets. If you would like to appear on a future episode of the Mums Podcast, please email mondayupbeatmarkets@gmail.com.